and welcome back to the Long Distance Love Bombs podcast. I am your host, Dr. Jeremy Goldberg, and my guest today is Figs O'Sullivan. Figs is a licensed marriage and family therapist. He is the emotional mentor that thought leaders go to, particularly in Silicon Valley. And in this conversation, we have a lot of fun, and we laugh a lot, and we talk about the waltz of pain, that dance that we so often get into but can't figure out how to get out of. We talk about empathy, but the word ending in I, which is a specific methodology that Figs has developed. We talk about why couples have the same fight over and over and over again, and why everything always makes sense, why everyone always makes sense. We talk about that being a core relational solution to some of the core relational problems and dynamics. And we also discuss the idea of reading emotion and how you can read emotions in people to cultivate more connection and more intention. This is a fun one. Figs is an Irish dude. He is a dad. He lives in Hawaii. He's very playful. He's very fun. He's very open in this conversation. And he said a couple of things that I am still thinking about days later. So if that is any indicator, I think that you are going to really enjoy this conversation with Figs O'Sullivan. Please do spread the word to anybody that you think might need this podcast or episode specifically. Every little bit helps. And thank you. So without further ado, please enjoy Figs. All right, Figs O'Sullivan, the buttons are pressed. We are officially underway. Thanks for stopping by the podcast.
Thank you so much, Jeremy, for having me on your show. I'm really excited.
And you're the first guest before recording to essentially give me a hint as to what not to ask as a first question. So I appreciate that.
Yeah.
But my first question was actually going to be, to those that don't know you, have no idea who Figs is, can you please describe who you are? Like, what's your deal?
Yeah, well, who I really am? Well, it's interesting. I usually start off with the profession, right? Because I assume the only reason to listen to me talk is like whatever way I've learned to be valuable to people. But so I'm primarily a couples therapist, psychotherapist. And but then I am a dad, probably most important, a dad and a husband, right? You know, and I was always, I think the deepest down longing for me was to be able to be part of a loving, connected family. Obviously, I would have loved to have it as a kid, right? That I was a kid inside of that. I didn't get to have it that way, you know? But now it's amazing. I get, you know, my most important thing, achievement in my life is that, you know, I go to bed every night with my wife and my two kids, right? Like, it's just, I'm living my biggest dream every day.
Congrats. Thank well you. Earned.
Yeah. Yeah. It took some work for sure.
Yeah. I'd love to hear more about that. And I'm curious if you'd be willing to expand a little bit more on your own childhood and what brought you into the space of being a relationship expert, couples counselor.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know a better way to say this. Again, I always feel like it's a cliche. I'm from Ireland, and my dad is, you know, is an alcoholic, recovered alcoholic. I grew up with, you know, I was conceived out of wedlock, you know, the shame in Irish families where the wedding had to happen and my birthday had to be hidden. Right. To like, you know, because it wasn't okay to actually have a baby that is born. I can't even, this is, you see a therapist, the math, right? It had to be after the 9 months after the wedding. Right. Okay. So, but look, I grew up with, look, you know, a heartbroken mother and an alcoholic father. Right. And so just a lot of anxiety, shame, uncertainty, fear, as a kid. Right. So, you know, in some ways, that's the betrayal, right? That's the biggest life betrayal, you know. But then, of course, inside of every betrayal is the opportunity, right, to turn it into your superpower, right? Like how to turn alchemy, right? How to turn base metal into gold. And I would say for my family, I feel very lucky that I think all of us did turn that base metal into gold, right? My dad went on to be a therapist. He's a very good therapist, won't stop, 79 this year, still obsessed with psychotherapy. And my sister's a therapist. My mom is a therapist, social worker. And then I became a therapist, right? And I became a therapist primarily, you know, I tried to fight against it. You know, I became a stockbroker. I think it was more like this, instead of it being the stockbroker journey for me, I went to like private schools in Ireland. I was really a poor kid with a bad Dublin accent, not the accent I have now, right? And I got sent to private schools and my accent was inappropriate. I was full of shame and unworthiness. And I don't know if like Canada where you're from is similar. There's just class is a bigger part of life. People can tell who you are and where you, just by your accent. You know, I grew up in Dublin where the culture where people ask you what school you went to. And the answer to that question pegs who you are. What sport did you play? So I just had a lot of like, not only all that family stuff, but I had a lot of like class shame, social shame. And so I really thought in my unformed teenage brain that and it was the 80s, right? That if I became a stockbroker and made money first, I could escape, right? I could escape all my unworthiness and shame and all of that. And I could escape to San Francisco, right? But anyway, so I did that for a while. And then I eventually, you know, gave all that up and moved to Esalen. I don't know if any of your listeners are familiar with Esalen, but Esalen is like, they call it the Harvard of the human potential movement. It's basically where Eastern philosophy meets Western psychotherapy. And a bunch of hippies dance around naked together at hot springs on the edge of the, you know, cliffs in Big Sur, California. And I lived there for a year and a half. And I think of Esalen as my third parent because that's where I really, this is crazy. I went there at 33 years old. And it was only at 33 years old that someone once asked me, how are you feeling? And I start telling them the story of my life. What's the latest neuroses I'm consumed with? And they said, wait a second. I asked you, how are you feeling? Feelings are sensations in your body. What are you noticing inside yourself right now? What's happening? I don't think I'd ever been prompted till 33 years of age to go inside, go into the universe inside of me. I'd spent up to 33 doing everything I could to avoid being inside of me, right? And so I really like that moment. It changed the whole course of my life, right? And so I refer to Esalen as my third parent, right? And so like, you know, I'm like doing existential, experiential psychotherapy during the day, dancing like lunatics sober, which was shocking as an Irishman, dancing in the morning sober. Like, what the hell is this all about? These people are mad. But then I just got really into it, right? It was just amazing. And yeah, and through all of that working on myself, and I couldn't imagine I'd ever be the person like facilitating emotional transformation for other people. Like, I was like, there's no way I could sit in that seat. And then eventually, you know, I kept working all the business stuff because I was too scared to really commit to being a therapist, like making the leap. And I found a program that I could go to school on the weekends and still work. And at that point, I was like the head of business development for a startup. And then the first time I ever sat with clients, I just was like, this is amazing. I just loved it. And so then it was just, you know, I was able to combine all of that business, marketing, like drive, rugby player drive with all of the soft skills of psychotherapy. And, you know, it's just been it's weird to say, a bit of a, you know, a just train, right? Like ever since, right? Just working on helping other people and growing a business in psychotherapy.
And then how long have you been full-time therapy at this point? Like, it sounds like you've been doing it a minute.
It's really hard. My wife's always like, Figs, like, you know, you have not been doing it 10 years. I still take 10 years. I think it's like 14 years or something now. Like, I'm really bad with long periods of time. It's like 14 or 15 years since this is all I've been doing, you know, committed as a pig in a ham and cheese sandwich to being a therapist.
Wait. Say that again. Committed as a pig in a ham.
I've been as committed as a pig in a ham and cheese sandwich to being a therapist, right? Like, you know what I mean? There's no plan B. There's no, oh, I'm just dabbling. I'm still doing, you know what I'm saying? Like, I was still doing the business stuff and doing therapy on the weekends. It's about 14, 15 years of this is it. There's nothing else.
Yeah. I've never heard that expression before, Figs.
Really? I love that expression. I don't know where I first heard it, but I love it. And you can use it now because I stole it, obviously, from someone else.
Yeah, committed as a pig in a ham and cheese sandwich. I relate to what you said earlier about the accents and the feeling as if you don't belong, because I grew up in Los Angeles, but I currently live in Canada. And in a former life, I was a scientist on the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, where I lived for about a decade. And there was this peculiar sense that I am here, I live here, this is home, but also at a deeper level, I don't fully belong here, or that I am an outsider. And I cannot figure out a way to reconcile that. It almost just persists, this pervasive feeling of otherness.
Yeah, well, look, that runs deep. And by the way, look, we were just saying before we hit record, I live on Oahu. I live in Hawaii. My wife was born and raised here, but she's a Haole, right? A white person. I am, for the listeners, I am white, right? I look like Shrek. I'm like a pale Irish. Like, if you, and I'm about the same size as Shrek, right? In family photos, everybody always tells me I have to put my head back, like to the back, because otherwise it just takes up half the shot, right? But look, I've somehow now picked a place, right? I'll never be local, right? Mm. Like, I'm always going to, like, now, by the way, I love it here and I believe in being deferential to the local Hawaiian people, Pacific Islanders. Like, I don't have a, let me be clear, I don't have any problem with it. There's no gripe, but it is from an emotional, like, familiarity. It's funny that I've chosen again to, like, live in a place that I'll always be a second class, not fully belonging to where I live person here, you know?
Do you think, putting on your therapy hat, what would you say about that decision? Or is it reflective of your childhood and upbringing?
Well, look, see, I don't have any pain around this. So let me tell you theoretically, I don't have a connection to this on this particular decision. But I'm sure there's that, you know, just because I can't see it doesn't mean it's not true. So let's just be interesting. Let me talk through it theoretically, why one would do that. And let me see if it becomes alive for me as I describe it, right? So look, if what's familiar is not belonging, and, you know, the best definition, I think, of shame emotionally is a feeling of separation from belonging. There's other definitions we can get into what it is biologically, but let's just say feeling a separation from belonging. So let's say my greatest pain, or one of my greatest pain, is shame, feeling separate from belonging. And I had it from not having a two-parent family. Dad's an alcoholic. Why are the police coming to the house? Being the poor kid with a weird accent in rich people's schools, right? Like, wanting my mom to drop me around the corner when all everyone else are in their Volvos. Like, can't believe I cared about that shit as a kid, but I did, right? Like, so, like, you know, like, when I went to college, I was like, I was trying to think about where all the THs were in the sentence I'm about to say, because if I mispronounce my THs, I'll give myself away as being this, like, you know, like a working class little grunt, right? But Okay. But so let's say that's familiar. Like that's deep in. That's deep in. That's separate from belonging. Well, here's the weird thing. That's where my organism is actually comfortable. Now, I may consciously think, I want to get out of separation from belonging. I don't like it. But on a deep level, you know, Eckhart Tolle is the first person I hear talk about this, like the pain body wants to live. Like it's an entity that wants to survive. And you're like feeling separate from belonging. I may consciously think I want to get rid of it, but it's actually where I'm most comfortable and most familiar. And then I will actually strive to stay in the comfort of the familiar against what I think I want to get rid of. Right. So this is, you know, people are always going to recreate their trauma, one, because it's familiar, but then two, because we are, in order to create, and if you're going to turn base metal into gold, right, like I was saying, the alchemical process, you have to recreate the trauma because there's a missing experience. Like the kid, let's say, there's no point in just being, let's say I arrived in Hawaii and they greeted me at the airport with trumpets and a band and woohoo, confetti. Yeah, we're here, figs, welcome. Come to the luau, right? You know, here's a big kahuna shirt for you, right? That wouldn't create the missing experience. The missing experience isn't being engulfed in belonging. The missing experience is I don't belong, it hurts, and I convert or transform, or that missing of belonging is transformed into belonging. So I'm creating the possibility by being back in a place of not belonging, the exact necessary fertile soil to have the transformation of becoming a part of a community, which is actually what my organism needs. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And I was asking it partially from a selfish perspective, because I had a moment years ago where I was listening to a podcast and I had to sit down and like contemplate my life, because at that point I was living abroad in Australia and I was a citizen of Australia at that point. So I had dual citizenship. I was an expat. And I had found that when I'm in America, I was missing Australia because it felt like home. And then when I was in Australia, I was missing America because that felt like home.
Yeah.
And also, when I grew up, my parents were divorced and both of them got remarried and had other children. And so I was literally like a game of Pong, just bouncing back and forth between these two homes. And, you know, I was in my 30s, sort of similar to your revelation about how are you feeling? And it hit me like, oh my God, I have manifest completely subconsciously my childhood upbringing as an adult with two countries replicating my home system.
Amazing.
It fucked me up, man.
Right. But that is, right? It is poetic. I'm not sure, you know, it's poetic. I don't know whether it's like beautiful poetry, but it is. It's amazing, right? That's incredible, right? Right, like you somehow recreate, but this is like, why recreate it? Like, because if I re-enter this place as a grown-up where I'd no control as a kid, but now you might be able to craft the missing experience. Now, we don't know what the missing experience is, right? But like, you don't know what the poetic, creative, righteous outcome, you know, whether I pick one place, I come to be at ease in my role, or like, you know, I don't know, but there's an opportunity for some kind of completion. That's why we'd recreate that scenario, right? But that's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. And now I was joking with a friend the other day that, well, now I'm in Canada and I've got my permanent residency and they asked if I'm going to get my citizenship. And I was like, oh, I'm like Jason Bourne. Now I just collect passports.
Right, yeah.
I'm like, well, what does that mean? Anyway.
Yeah. Well, look, here's where I would say from a psychotherapeutic point of view, how you would come to the deepest, most trustworthy answer to that is we'd want to, what, let's say what I sometimes refer to as time travel, Right. We wouldn't want to answer it with those questions with your neocortex. We'd want to see if we could get down to the child, the one who lived in between the two houses, and not the narrating self that now has a story about that was like. We'd want to see, that's what I call it, time travel. We want to see if we could somehow, through the craft of experiential psychotherapy, have you feel again the moment-to-moment experience, what it smelt like, what it's like to be living inside that world, that I mean, shift from place to place, and see if we could actually let that part of you actually feel the grief, the pain, whatever it is. I don't want to put what, but whatever that vulnerable experience is, to feel it completely, be immersed 100% in it, and then love and care for that little boy that had to live in this world that he had no choice in, right? This is just grownups doing their thing, and this is my reality. And then from that place, then we ask, what does he want? That would be the most trustworthy answer to what am I doing? How am I doing this over and over again? What is it that is needed to happen for me that I keep recreating the scenario?
Yeah, and maybe that's a good segue to hopefully get us relatively back on track with what I thought we were going to talk about.
Yeah.
Of why do people, what's the actual question? I know that you had a great phrase on your website that I wanted to ask you about, which referred to the waltz of pain that couples occasionally do. And you've also done some great work around having the same fight or argument again and again and again. And so I think that's a very relatable thing for those listening in terms of how do we navigate or escape from those cycles?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's great. So let me see if I can answer relatively briefly and systematically.
Time, Figs. It's all good.
Well, yeah. But I want to say, because there's a few different points, right? I think, you know, firstly, just go like piggybacking off what we were just talking about. Hold on, I have to belch. Drinking kombucha has a downside. Okay, excuse me. That's about as big. By the way, there's another thing. I wasn't a good belcher as a kid.
Oh.
I couldn't understand how people could do these loud belches. I was always a pretty lame, crap belcher.
Because that's like social proof, right? It's like
you're, exactly. You're like it was a real, yeah, you had to be able to do a loud belch as a teenage boy, right? But, okay. But so, come here.
I could add one in like post-production. Yeah. It's like, oh, man.
Thank you. Like impressive. A real, like, way, that fella can belch like Shrek. Okay, so... So just piggybacking, look, why would we get one? Just look, we're going to get in the same fight over and over again because there's a missing experience. Both people want to have, they're having the same fight over and over again is because they're hoping for a different outcome, right? The organism is hoping for a different outcome, right? Like maybe this time I can get the outcome that the little kid in me never, ever got before. And both people are doing that, right? So let's back up. Why do people get in the same fight over and over again? The most important point is just attachment theory, right? And attachment theory is the best theory we have of what love is. And in short, love is the need to be emotionally bonded / attached, right? And everybody needs to be attached, like biologically, physiologically, from the cradle to the grave. It's not optional. Even though you're very happy with your Netflix subscription and Amazon Prime subscription, you're like, I need nobody. Look, just physiologically, from the moment you were born, right? If there wasn't another person on the other side of your birth, you would die. So your body's built to detect, even before it can detect, I am hungry, right? I could really do with a kebab right now. Right? Your body's first primed to detect, oh, Jesus, there's no one here, and I'm about to get eaten, shout out to Australia, by a dingo. Right? So that doesn't change because you're a grown-up, and it doesn't change because now you're like mad sophisticated with all your technology, and you think you don't need people. Your body is still built to freak, again, I'm going to use a technical term, freak the fuck out when it looks like your person's not there for you. And so when you're a baby, it was your mom, whoever raised you, right? And so you were totally right to freak out when it looked like they were not physically or emotionally there for you. And you were also totally right to freak out when it looked like they were disappointed in you, right? That it looked like you were not enough for them. And they're the two sides of wounding and love. I'm freaking out because you're not there for me. I'm freaking out because it looks like you won't be here for me because I'm a disappointment. You're either going to be abandoned on one side of love or rejected on the other. Okay. So that's the most, like, everything that human beings do in love and relationship can be understood through their attachment fears got triggered. It looks like I'm going to be abandoned or rejected, right? Some flavor thereof. So attachment is primary. Then the second theory, then you add layer on top of that, is systems theory. And systems theory is just very simple. You're not islands, despite, like, if the listeners are living in America and, like, you know, you've learned all about the beauty of individualism and you have a right to pursue happiness. And if anyone gets in your way, fuck them. They're not right for me. I only want positive people in my life. And this message, by the way, like right now, right, this message is really getting propagated, right? Put out negative people, only have friends with people that are, like, you know, inspiring you, right? Like, fucking ridiculous. Forgive my French. Okay. Now, so systems theory, when you're hurt, when you get in touch with your unmet love need and you get, like, terrified inside, even though you're not realizing you're terrified, you protest. Oh, you're a negative person. Whatever way you do it, like, oh, you got to stop being blaming and criticizing. My guru online told me, right? You know, I don't deserve to be spoken to like that. Whatever way you protest, it's going to terrify the other person because you're their person. Now they're threatened. Now they're not getting the flavor of love, right? And now they protest, like, back. They shut down, go to the pub for an extra four drinks because they don't want to deal with you criticizing them, whatever it is they do. And now you're even more terrified and you've even got more criticism to give them. They are even more terrified. And so now they're actually going to book a room above the pub so they never have to come home. You, the two people, created a system together because of the way they're both built physiologically that we need love. When it's not there, we both get scared and we both protest and we both scare each other even more. Look, they're the two most important things. They're the two most important things. And this is the thing. What's so hard is everything else is noise. Someone's going to say, no, but Figs, they really are an anti-vaxxer. Like, listen, this isn't about vaccinations. I know you think you guys are fighting about vaccinations or you're fighting about who walks the dog. When you ask your partner to walk the dog, they get scared. You're disappointed in them. And that's why they go, Jesus, I walked the dog yesterday. And you're like, they're just never there for me because you just got threatened. And that's why you say, I can't believe you're keeping score. You guys are both, you both scared each other on a love level. This is not about the bloody dog and who walks the dog. And nor is it about, like, look, I'm having extra vaccinations on Friday. Why won't you have at least one? Right? It's never about the topic people think they're fighting about. So why do people then get into the waltz of pain? And let me refer to what the waltz of pain is. The waltz of pain refers to the negative part of that systemic dance, that waltz. And there's three main steps. Like, the reason anybody takes these three steps is they're hurting inside when they're not feeling loved, right? So ultimately, the only reason people do the waltz is because they're both hurting inside because they're not feeling loved. They're experiencing their partner as withholding a flavor of love, and it hurts, it's threatening. And so then they do these three steps, both people. Step number one, I see the other person negatively. I judge them. You. Right? Step two, I have a reactive emotion, an emotion that has a because of you at the end. I'm angry at you. I'm frustrated with you. I'm disappointed in you. You confuse me. You make no sense, right? And then there's an action born out of, I see you negatively and I'm frustrated, mad, annoyed by you. And that action is now, and there's a million different flavors of action, right? I'm going to blame you, criticize you, walk away from you, minimize you, placate you. just all the different things that people do. Explain what you're doing wrong really nicely, offer you a book that may help you, right? All of those actions, when it's born out of a negative judgment and you're in secondary motion, right? Those three things, one, two, three, begets from the other person because it hurts them. But then you're going to get from the other person their one, two, three. They'll now see you negatively as the withholder of love. They're going to be in a secondary emotion. And then their action is going to be born out of that, which will make you do what? It's going to hurt you. And then you're going to do one, two, three. It's going to hurt the other person. Then they're going to do one, two, three. And now, for those like me that learned how to waltz as a kid with their mom, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three. And so the couple keeps scaring the living daylights out of each other inside of this waltz of pain. But think about a waltz. You're not waltzing on your own. It takes two people to waltz. So that's the first key transformation. Both people, when they're locked inside the waltz of pain, they only see it from their subjective experience. And so the big thing that I have to help people do, right, is I have to help them zoom out and see the two dance partners, like get out of your own experience and see the dance from the outside. Look at this waltz of pain that we are creating together. We're both hurting and we're both looking at each other negatively, having reactive emotions and action tendencies that hurt the other person. This is so painful for both of us. That's that key first, like, transformation, that we go from this is a me or you problem to this is an us problem. Not because we're bad, but because we actually love each other so much, we both get hurt and threatened when it looks like we're not there for each other the way we long for each other to be there.
I love this a lot. And I feel personally attacked, Figs, in some regard. Like, oh.
You do?
I've done that. I'm having flashbacks to conversation. That's right. I did.
Everybody does it.
Yeah.
By the way, this is, you know, my wife and I, is not a plug. My wife and I have our own podcast. We share our own therapy sessions. We talk about our own relationship. And part of why we do it is like, look, if you love someone, you're going to get threatened and you're going to react. Mm. No one gets to be like, I used to say the Dalai Lama, but now he's in the news this week for something weird. I didn't even read the article. I don't even want to know. It's terrible. I'm not ready. But look, even like supposed couples therapists, I get hurt when it looks like my wife's not there for me and I'm reactive. And then it hurts her and she's reactive. You just want to shorten the amount of time you're in your waltz of pain without seeing it from the outside and being able to soften. Nobody gets to a place that you're never doing it.
Yeah. It seems like if you, continuing with this metaphorical waltz, if you notice that you're taking the first step of the three-step waltz, it seems like that is a strategic maneuver to prevent the entire dance from happening. So is it like noticing, I'm being negative right now, or I'm being reactive right now in the second step, or is that too simplified?
So here's the interesting thing about that, right? Look, the waltz is helpful, right? This is the weird thing. Like, look, some people's waltzes, like, let's put it to you this way. If you're like, I see them negatively, I'm angry at you, and so then I slash their tires of their car. And then the other person is, oh, wow, you slashed my tires of your car. I see you negatively. I'm angry at you, so I burn your passport. Like, yeah, we'd probably need to help that couple notice earlier they're in a cycle to stop them actually engaging in criminal behavior, right? Okay. And obviously, in all seriousness, domestic violence, there's domestic violence we got to work individually. We can't have you work together on your cycle because it's probably too risky. We got to get to a place that you're not actually a threat to hurting each other or blocking each other's exits or any of that kind of coercing each other. Like, so all seriousness, everything we're talking about assumes there's not a risk of domestic violence when we study your relationship with another human being. Okay. But look, there is a value to the cycle. Just think, if everything I said is true, the cycle gets us back in the missing experience that the little kids inside you that are still here and always here. If you succeeded in never getting into your waltz of pain, you would also succeed at never creating the right fertile environment for the little vulnerable ones to go, hey, you know why I protested? You know, I saw you negatively. I got scared you weren't here. I thought it was happening again. We'd never get to hear from the most vulnerable parts in both of you. So this is the weird thing. Instead of thinking, most people, this is what they do, is go, okay, how do we get to a place we never do our waltz of pain? I don't want you to not do your waltz of pain. I want you to get to a part that you see the waltz of pain for what it is. It's like you love each other so much, you scare each other. And for some very temporary period of time, it looks like the worst thing is happening again for both of you. But then you get to the other side of that, and let's get there quicker before you know, cars are damaged, passports are burned, right? It just takes a long time to get tires, you know, repaired, passports, you know, replaced. So let's try and get it before that. And then the magic of relationship is in the repair. The magic is not in being good. This is another thing that drives me crazy. You know what sells? What sells is trying to teach people how to be good. Stop trying to be fucking good. I want like, look, you freaking get mad because you love someone so much. They disengage because they love you so much. It's so painful when you're disappointed in them. So let's see it for what it is. And then, again, technical language. Now let's love the shit out of the little ones that were hurt when you were fighting. That's what we got to be able to do. Not try and avoid the waltz of pain completely. Mm.
So not to stop the dancing in the first place, but rather to notice that you're dancing or that your partner is dancing. And then
we are dancing. Yeah. But yeah.
Compassionately inquire as to why you are dancing.
Well, and then the you is a shared you, right? That's the thing. We want to, the big shift, the first big shift is to move from I consciousness to we consciousness. And that I think I consciousness, you're still in the story of other or story of yourself, but we want to go to look at the way we are dancing. That's the big shift. Right? That you're like, you have a drone's eye view, right? Or you're in the audio. At first, you're Daniel Day-Lewis playing the character, and your partner is Meryl Streep or, like, you know, Kiefer Sutherland or, you know, whoever, right? And then you realize, right? You realize, like, you know, or like, you know, Martin Scorsese is in the audience, or whoever, Sofia Coppola or whatever. They're in the behind the camera, right? Or, you know, watching, and they say, hey, come here, actors, come look at the whole scene. And then the actors look at the whole scene. When they were playing the roles, they only felt the pain of their individual characters. And then they see the scene played back to them on the camera. And they feel the pain of that scene, of the two characters as a gestalt, as a whole. That's the big change. And by the way, this is like empathy. Like most people, when they think, and that's the name of our company, right? Empathy with an I on the end, not a Y on the end, not a plug. But the reason it's called empathy, and this is really important, most people understand empathy as a one-way thing. I come, Jeremy, and I tell you, look, I stubbed my toe this morning. It's bleeding. I'm a man. I need to talk about my injury now for at least an hour. And you go, no, Figs, don't worry. Tell me all about it. We're like, how much blood was there? Right? Like, you're just like empathizing. One-way empathy. I'm hurting. You're feeling my hurt, and you're sharing with me. I get you, Figs. I'm with you. I'm here to hear it. I accept your experience. I validate your experience. Of course it makes sense. And I'm like, I'm going to let that empathy in. Right. But what we're trying to do is create two-way empathy, like empathy multiplied by two, where we're both hurting and we're both able to feel the pain. I actually empathize with my pain and your pain at the same time. It's like an exponentially bigger experience of empathy. Very hard for people to do. And again, that's the craft of the work. And it's really weird for people not first working on trying to solve a problem, working on trying to see if we could have this like empathy squared experience. And we literally change people's brain chemistry and rewiring their brain, their limbic system. Oh my God, I can feel really bad for you and me. But just think about how weird and paradoxical that is. everything people are doing is trying to stay away from the hopelessness that I'm abandoned and not loved, the hopelessness I'm rejected and not good enough. They're both dead. And I'm actually trying to get them to both feel that and then actually have empathy for each other down there, because that's where we need them to love each other and be a team. So, and it's really counterintuitive that that could make things better.
It's like the advanced level stuff. And you are somewhat like the Steven Spielberg of marriage and family therapy, in that you're seeing the scene play out and you're trying to express that bigger picture to both parties so that they can see exactly outside of themselves as to what's happening.
Exactly. And just like Steven Spielberg, and this is really important, not as facts. I become, and this is, like I say, the most important skill. I shouldn't say the most important skill, right? Because there's probably lots of important skills. One of the most important skills is you have to be able to become people and show them not just factually what's happening. I need to be able to become the abandoned one and become how the abandoned one turns into a big protester to protect the abandoned one. I got to be able to become the rejected one inside of their partner and then become the way the rejected one turns into someone that protects the rejected one, and then become all four of them in one coherent narrative and play back the movie full of aliveness and realness, the real like acid trip terror it is never going to end that the kids are in, and the real look, I have to fight for my life and protect myself, defend myself, fight back of the protectors. And so I show these people, look at who you are, what you're doing. You both deserve, you both make so much sense, and this is so tragic. I feel it all for them. That's how you got to be mad, right? I'm going to feel it all for them. And then like, and they like, oh my God, that's us. Look how sad this is for me and you. And then look, I don't know how it happens. I don't know if it's just a collective breath. I don't know if it's one person will finally look to make eye contact and the other person will take the eye contact. I don't know if it's that one person risks reaching their hand out and the other person squeezes it. That's a big transformation. Look how painful this is for both of us. That's much more important than behaving well. That experience is gold. That is the missing experience. It looked like there was no way back to each other. And we went deeply, deeply down into the pain. And we were able to be in it together and feel empathy and compassion for how awful this is for both of us. Hardest thing to do. And I won't stop trying to help. If a couple comes to see me, I'm sorry. I will not stop trying to help them have that experience. They can stop, but I won't.
Because it's that important and vital.
It's everything. Again, it's like, this is why we're in relationship, right? Like, I got hurt in the past. I really want to somehow resolve this so I can make love work, but it's fucking terrifying. So we got to have that experience. Because everything people do to stay away from feeling abandoned and rejected, whatever your particular like level of wounding is, ashamed, it makes things worse. It's like you're throwing a boomerang. It guts your partner and then it comes back and guts you, and you're shocked. The way you protect yourself, defend yourself, hurts your partner, your boss, your coworker, the person you're getting in a road rage incident with. The way you protect yourself, you're buying groceries and you don't look at the checker, right? The cashier, because you don't feel good in yourself and you don't want to be in contact with the world. Well, guess what? Totally makes sense you'd protect yourself like that. But guess how it feels for the cashier? It hurts them. And so now they're going to like throw your can of tomatoes down, right? And you're like, it's like, well, they're making it harder for me to not feel seen. Like, look, we're creating these systems all the time with people, but it's going to be loudest and biggest with our, you know, significant others, fam, like kids, parents, coworkers, boss, like, we're just, yeah.
I interviewed a woman called Madeline Moon, and she was talking about sort of energizing the theatrics of the dynamic and really playing up the characters. And so if you're feeling jealous, to really express that in a fun, playful manner and as a way of making it more known as to what the individual is feeling and making it very clear as to, yeah, I'm angry right now. Like, I want to burn this whole apartment down. So I view that as one way to help the other person understand what you're feeling inside, to understand the part that the other is playing. Are there ways that you have to help heighten that empathetic response from the partner?
So let me say, there's a few, let me talk to this, there's a few reasons why you would heighten one's reactivity. So remember, instead of thinking there's one of you, let's simplicity, there's two of you. There's a vulnerable one that's not feeling loved. And at some point, we're going to want to heighten that. So, right, we're going to want you to become, how do we help you become the unloved one? We're going to want to access that part of you and help you be immersed in that part of you. But in order to have a chance to do that, right, that's the most protected part of you, right? You don't even know all the ways you're protecting that part of you, right? But in order to have a chance to do that, we have to win the trust of the protector. So the angry one, let's say you're like someone, I fucking don't get treated that way. I'll fucking fight anyone tries to hurt me, right? Whatever way, you know, you do that, right? Let's say, look, if I ever have a chance of accessing, the only reason someone acts like that is they must be actually hurting and scared inside in some way. I'm going to have to accept and validate the reactive one. Well, one way I could accept and validate the reactive one is I'm going to totally make sense you're angry, and I could actually be as angry as the person, or even better, I could be even angrier than the person in a funny, playful way. So it wouldn't be uncommon. Let's say one of my, like a couple of examples, let's say one time, like I have someone that's pissed at an ex, right? What I'll do every time they mention the ex, I'll go like this. I'll do a big loogie and spit on the ground. All right, because I'll be even more resentful of the ex, right? Or like someone that, look, I'm likely, if you fucking disrespect me, I'm going to go wild angry, right? I'll like ask him, do you have your yellow, like Uma Thurman jumpsuit from Kill Bill on today? Because like, I already feel it. If we're in a cafe right now, I'd be going to the other customers and saying, like whispering, I would get out now.
Yeah.
I would leave. Right. So a lot of times people can see the truth of themselves more in exaggeration. It's safer to see the truth in an exaggeration of the depiction of yourself. Weirdly, you don't want to be actually pretty good at it. Right. But than it is to show someone accurately who they are.
Yeah. I've heard an example of this in a restaurant whereby the manager is dealing with an angry customer that's complaining about the food and says something like, you're right. I'm so sorry. I'm going to go fire the chef right now. This is unacceptable. Right. He's gone. Right. As a way of escalating the scenario. And then the angry customer then kind of backs down. It's like, well, no, it's not that bad. It helps to kind of.
Well, yeah. And that's a slightly different concept, right? You know, this thing, what you resist persists. So as long as you're resisting what someone says, they'll have to keep escalating. If you go with them, it's almost like a paradoxical intervention, right? As long as you're resisting someone, again, imagine their reactive one is a person that needs to be heard. You moving with them, now they feel heard and they no longer have to keep expressing their frustration. So look, there's multiple things in there. Exaggeration's actually easier to see. Don't resist people. Stop resisting people. Like if you don't want someone to be angry, the quickest way to stop them being angry is join them in their anger. I had something recently, like I do outrigger canoeing, and some guy almost got in a fight with these two other outrigger canoers in front of his son, and he felt really disrespected in front of his son. And then he sees me. I have nothing to do with them, no idea, but he sees me putting my canoe on my car, and he comes up to me and he's like, right, he's going to have it out with me because I'm an outrigger canoer. Well, he's telling me all the terrible things that happened. What do you think I did? Do you think I, who wasn't me? What are you blaming me for? Right. Did I, I didn't resist them at all. I'm like, you are absolutely right. That is terrible. And by the way, I'm not like just doing it. It is terrible. Is he's fishing with his son. These guys are shouting at him, like in front of his son. Like, I don't have to work really hard to empathize with. I'm not going to resist anything. I absolutely get why you'd be upset. That is terrible. Right in front of your son, and you're fishing on the weekend. That is not right. I'm so sorry that happened to you. Right? Like, what is he? He's got nothing. He can't keep resisting, like, you know, what it is. Like, keep going down. He's angry as hell, and he wants to beat the living daylights out of the next outrigger canoeer he finds, right?
Yeah, I'm just reflecting on back when I have been very angry. It's almost like a sneaky way to diffuse my own anger when someone validates it.
Like, absolutely.
Or gets angry with you. It's like, yeah, let's go. Grab the pitchforks. It's on.
Exactly.
It's like, oh, yeah, no, okay. No, we don't need a pitchfork, but it feels good that you'd join me if I needed one.
Yeah, and that's where, like, look, it's great, right? And that's, you know, I train therapists. I'm always like, look, you have to see everybody as valid, right? You have to see everyone as valid. You got to see. Everybody always makes sense. We're not saying, like, you know, if you chase someone down the road because they cut you off and you follow them to their house and you threaten them and tell them, now I know where you live. Not saying that's okay, but look, you felt not considered. Let's say we did some exploration. You felt not considered. You felt powerless. It really matters to be considered. And there was no way for you to actually express that. So you followed the person and you needed to make them feel terrible and really get what they did to you. Hey, listen, I get it. It totally makes sense. I get it. But, and then I'm going to hold my hands up like this. And hey, listen, we do have to explore how you're chasing people down freeway, even if you make sense. I don't think that's good for you. But hands up, don't shoot me. You do make sense, but like there's a little bit of a, there must be some trauma there if that's what you're doing when you get cut off on the freeway. We should explore that. But I don't, you notice I'm throwing in the, look, we should explore the vulnerability you must be experiencing. I'm saying two things at the same time. You must have been heard, but the only way I have a right to say that is I'm going to validate. It totally makes sense. It's so frustrating when someone cuts you off. No wonder you'd be mad as hell. Anyway, I don't know how we got on this particular point, but yeah.
Oh, I like it, man.
Yeah. Validating people is essential, right? Just got to stop being oppositional to people, even when you don't like what they're saying. Like, let me give you an example, right? I'm in San Francisco, like, I live in Hawaii now, but San Francisco, right? And I have a Trump supporter come in, right? And they tell me how much they hate the city, fucking Mexicans, bullshit. I can't even walk down the street in my red hat without threat of, like, being beaten up. And, like, I could lose my job if people knew, fuck this city, right? Now, you know, like, San Francisco, progressive. I could get caught up in the, I'm sorry, excuse me, what was that about Mexicans? I'm sorry, what was that? You know what I mean? I could get caught up, or I could go, wait a second, that fucking is bullshit. Wait a second. Like, you cannot in this city wear a hat with a particular political slogan without being at risk of being beaten up. You could lose your job for having a different political point of view. That's the world you live in when you walk. And again, so I'm actually becoming, it's not like just empty validation. Wait a second. I may not agree with their politics, but that is bullshit. That is bullshit. That's ridiculous. People should be allowed to wear their bloody little red hat. I mean, red is ruined for me. Right? But they should be allowed to wear their red hat, right? Without risk. So, and by the way, validating that part of them opens the door to a much deeper, they live in a very scary world. Much deeper. Nothing to do with politics, nothing to do with Democrats, Republicans, Trump, Mexicans and they're, you know, they're like their focus of what they're scared of. There's a much deeper fear inside. There's a little kid that was scared long before there were like Trumps and Make America Great hats. I would never get a chance to talk to that little scared kid if I immediately was oppositional, like, hey, I'm not sure it's a really good idea to be singling out an ethnic group, right? At some point, I might be able to go, but yeah, you got to validate people. Got to find a way to validate people.
Yeah, so I'm curious. You were referred to as reading emotion as well as an IBM computer, according to an article or a media release that I saw. And so I'm curious, how does one read emotion? Because it seems to tie into everything we just discussed there. Do you have any pointers or practices to help us do so?
Well, so firstly, I think it was 2015, and the conclusion was that I was better than IBM Watson. Oh, thank God, right? I'd understanding emotional tone and context in written correspondence, which is obviously much harder than seeing someone's face. So here's what would be a your body is your own instrument. You got to know feelings and emotions. You got to be able to be affected inside yourself in order to be able to read other people. But this is the hard part. In order to understand what someone else is feeling, this is the weird thing. Most of your attention needs to be on yourself, right? This is your barometer. When someone says something, you got to notice what it touches in you to be able to see what's happening for the other person. So grow your ability to be affected. Grow your ability. And I say affected, that I can feel sad. I can feel angry. Like, you have access to all the keys of your piano, right? Like, feeling the feelings, right? That you can dive into them, feel them, you can become. Now, you're going to be at risk of being seen as a snowflake. Because most of the time he was like, that was no big deal. You didn't actually get in a crash. I don't know why you're like feeling all traumatized, right? But we actually want to help people feel more fully. Now, listen, there almost was a crash. You had a second where your body went into, that's a really big deal. We want to grow your ability to be affected. And then you can help grow other people's ability to be affected. And you can see signs that they're affected. And then the other thing is being able to make empathic conjectures, right? With a question at the end. So let's say you're looking at someone and you imagine they're sad. Make an empathic conjecture. Here's what an empathic conjecture is. You're sad, but very importantly, comma, huh? It gives you, as opposed to being a declarative statement, you've opened, let's say you're wrong. Well, it's great if you're wrong, because now they'll tell, no, I'm not sad. I'm not happy. Oh, you're not happy. That sucks, right? I'm going to accept and validate, right? You have to be able to take the risk of being wrong, but also not telling other people who they are. Right. If you give people room, so you got to stop describing other people and actually, like, you can make conjecture and give them room to tell you what they're really actually feeling. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's a lot of really good actionable advice that you are laying out today, rather than just fluffy, idealized versions of, you know, just manifest the namaste and abundance mindset and all the rest. It's like, hang on, here's the three-step thing that you need to know. So the scientist in me appreciates that tremendously.
Oh, good. Yeah. Look, this stuff is actually quite simple. It's not easy, but it is actually quite simple. But it just takes practice.
What is something in your own relationship that you are currently practicing or up-leveling? Is there anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, let me see. No, it's a really good question. But so I want to really think about what am I practicing in my own relationship that I want to up level? I'd say one of the things that's really up for me at the moment is, you know, because I'm, you know, a couples therapist, I'm sitting with couples and I'm working with couples and I'm in this stew of all this, like you're hurting and you're reactive and I can have all these love feelings for my wife, right? Because I'm primarily able to empathize with other people because I'm feeling all these things inside myself and I'm putting myself in the client and I can like, my wife, our relationship. And I have all these positive affect and really in touch with what we mean to each other. And then I come up the stairs and I see her and I say, did you call the gardeners? Like, what the fuck? Like, I like, so balancing my neurotic worry brain that's always trying to make sure the next thing is done. Like, it's so easy for me to lose touch with the, and then do the acknowledgement. Hey, I thought a lot about you today. I leave my wife crestfallen. Like the other day, like, you know, she's cycling up the hill and I'm walking down, I'm talking to a friend and I see her and I was literally having all these positive feelings. And I'm talking to a friend and I said, hey, tell Cheryl that her coconuts are about to fall off. What the fuck? Like, what the fuck? Right? Like that wasn't like, hey, sweetie, love you. Right? Like, no, just like straight into a suggestion, trying to get something off my to-do list onto hers. Right. How would I define what that is? I'm really working on not letting my overwhelm interfere with me sending positive attachment messages, especially on partings and coming back together. Because those moments are key. Like when you see your person, you want to see I'm enough for them and they're there for me. If what you see is like, call the plumber, right? That is not a you're enough for me and I'm here for you, right? It's literally the opposite, right? So I'm trying to get better and not letting my internal overwhelm interfere with how I show up as an attachment figure for my wife and kids.
Yeah. I appreciate you sharing so honestly. And I relate to that as well and have on the other end of that received a, oh, it's nice to see you too. Or,
right.
Oh, I love you too. I'm like, oh shit. Yeah. Sorry. Should have led with that.
I would have saved
me some time and energy.
But by the way, but here's the good news, right? Getting things wrong is okay. Cause remember, the magic of relationship is in the repair. What did I say to my wife when I saw her after I'd done my walk, talking to my friend, right? Of course I told my friend, this is like, what am I doing? You just heard what I said to my wife when I saw her cycling up the hill. What the fuck is wrong with me? But what did I do when I saw my wife? I'm like, hey, I am so sorry. Like, what the fuck? Like, I see you cycling, you're smiling at me, and I shout at you to remember to tell the neighborhood, like, not to let the coconuts fall on our kids' heads, right? As I'm a worrier, right? Like, I am so sorry. Like, I was actually thinking really positive about you, but that's what comes out of my mouth. Oh my God. What a difference that makes, right? To be able to repair afterwards. Right. So you remember, you're not going to get it right all the time. It's okay to get it wrong as long as you repair.
And it's so much quicker and easier to do it frequently as it arises like that, rather than, I'm sure you have seen this in your sessions or your life, where 6 months later, it's like, oh, and that one time you told me about the coconuts as I was riding up the hill, right? And it
exactly.
Kind of gets buried or hidden.
Yeah.
Not that you would ever do that or her, but.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, I mean, look, I am a worrier. It's a thing. My worrying interferes with the quality of my worrying. And then I get overwhelmed. It interferes with the quality of my presence for the people I am an attachment figure for. It's an affliction, right? And so, it is what it is. I am who I am. I'm like, you know, we all have stuff. You have your afflictions. Everyone has their afflictions, right? But just think about how much better that is for my wife and kids that I know. And I'm not going to double down and defend myself. Well, the coconut tree does need to be like dealt with, right? I'm not going to just defend myself and double down. I'm like, hey, listen, I am a worrier and I totally talked to you in a way I shouldn't in that moment because my own internal overwhelm and the way I worried like overrided the way I would have longed to show up for you. And then here's the key magical question, because I want them to experience themselves when I do this with my kids. What's it like to hear your dad say, tell you he gets that he didn't talk to you the way he should have? I'm sorry. What does it feel like to hear me say that? So I'm growing their ability to notice their own experience when an attachment figure actually shows up and gives them the love they needed now that I wasn't able to give them in that moment, and I was consumed with my own neurotic bullshit.
Mm. Well, here's a random fact that you might not know is that coconuts kill more people every year than sharks.
Oh, I am not surprised. That, I'm not thank sure that you.
Thank assuages you. Your worry or exacerbates it, but nonetheless, it's
well,
just
no, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I'm now going to be having petitions signed for dealing with all the coconuts. But
yeah, all right, Figs. Well, it's been about an hour and a bit. I'm conscious of time and energy, and I so appreciate your vibe, man. I've loved this conversation.
Thank you. Likewise.
The work you're doing. For those listening, I know you've got an Instagram and a website that I'll put in the show notes, but is there any other places that you...
The only other thing I would say, like, given, you know...
Your podcast.
We have a podcast, right? Like, your listeners or podcast listeners. So maybe the podcast would be good to check out, and it's called Come Here to Me podcast. And like I said, we kind of mix the episodes up. My wife and I talk about our relationship, like counter shame people, show what you're going through is normal. And then we also do some like explaining key things, right? About how to have a better relationship.
Yeah. Sounds great. So go listen, go subscribe, check it out. And hopefully I can meet you in real life one day and we can share a coconut.
I think you need to get over. I just saw there's flights from Vancouver to Oahu. So you'll have to come visit.
Yeah, man. All right. Thank you, brother.
Cheers. Thank you.
So that was Figs O'Sullivan. As mentioned, he has a website, an Instagram account, and a podcast. I will put links to those in the show notes. And I hope that you enjoy learning more about the waltz of pain and how everyone always makes sense, how you can read emotions. So it was a good conversation. So thank you for being here. Thanks for listening. Please do share and spread the word. Every little bit helps. And as per usual, you can find me on Instagram at Long Distance Love Bombs. I've got a book and a newsletter that goes out every week or two. I just adore you. Thanks for listening. And I will talk to you soon.